Coming up on Philosophy Talk, we'll look at the works of W.E.B. Du Bois,
author of The Souls of Black Folk.
The Negro is a sort of seventh son, born with a veil and gifted with second sight in this American world. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others.
To me, one of the interesting things about Du Bois is that he constantly attended to complexities and nuance.
Our guest is Lucius Outlaw.
I'm a graduate of Fisk University, so my encounter with Du Bois was pretty profound. And the lead-off epigraph for my dissertation is really from The Souls of Black Folk, and is that segment that speaks about, you know, double consciousness. So it had quite an impact on me.
The legacy of W.E.B. Du Bois, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Hi, I'm Josh Landy. W.E.B. Du Bois was born on February 23rd, 1868, and celebrated his 58th birthday shortly after what became our current Black History Month. So let's listen to this vintage episode with John and Ken about Du Bois' life and thought.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Everything except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you, as always, from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local, innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
An oasis of thought. And from that oasis of thought, it migrates to this oasis of the radio. And from here, it migrates to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And now you can join. We've joined the podcast revolution. If you go to our webpage and click on the links there, it'll take you to our podcast.
So, Ken, today we're talking about W.E.B. Du Bois, a great man. He was born just after the Civil War in 1868 and died just before Martin Luther King's great speech in 1963. When I think about Du Bois, I've read several of his books and studied him over the years. But when I was growing up in Lincoln, Nebraska, a town named after the great emancipator, a town a good 80 miles north of the Mason-Dixon line, a town that was legally integrated, unlike the towns down in Kansas at that time, we never heard of Du Bois. We heard about George Washington Carver and the Peanut. We heard about Booker T. Washington and Up From Slavery, but I don't think I heard the name Du Bois mentioned until I was in college.
Well, that's kind of interesting. Maybe that was because in Lincoln, I mean, Du Bois was a intense analyst and social critic of the situation of Black people in America. Maybe they just couldn't stomach his message in Lincoln. Maybe they just didn't want to. Maybe they preferred that accommodationist message of Booker T. Washington. But I do have to say that, you know, Du Bois really was a highly consequential intellectual. And he did it mostly through his writings. But, you know, and he kind of was a founding generations of Black thinkers and writers were deeply influenced by Du Bois, and they keep returning to him. But I do have to say that philosophy, our discipline, for a long time didn't pay much attention to Du Bois. That's partly because the things he was really deeply gripped about, race, culture, identity, philosophers in the 20th century, except for like the pragmatists and some people now, weren't paying much attention to that stuff. And then when we started paying attention to that, we said, wow, look at these writings of Du Bois.
But I think philosophically, Du Bois is an important figure, even apart from his effect on the Black consciousness and the Harlem Renaissance and all those great things. He was kind of a figure that fits between Emerson and the Transcendentalists, where I think he got the seeds of his concept of double consciousness, and American pragmatists like Mead, who developed this kind of the I versus the me, or even an existentialist like Sartre, who has this.
So tell me more about double consciousness.
Well, double consciousness is we all have this consciousness of who we are that just comes from being human. We're the person who sees the things we see and does the things we do, and we have memories of what we've done, and we have some sense of who we are that way. But in addition, living in a world like we do, we have other people that talk about us and develop concepts of who we are based on information, misinformation, and those feed back into us. We have to deal with both of those concepts. If we can't make them fit, and I think Du Bois is saying that any African-American is going to have a lot of trouble making them fit, then we've got this double consciousness.
It's going to be particularly striking for African-American consciousness, right? Because on the one hand, especially the times Du Bois was writing, the African-American is the despised other, right, by this powerful group of whites. And then he's got to conceive of himself. Am I American? Am I Negro? Am I of this or not of this? To help us think about that more, Polly Stryker, our roving philosophical reporter, went out and talked to some folks about the concept of double consciousness. She files this report.
W.E.B. Du Bois is a name I associate with the Harlem Renaissance and the rise of the black intellectual at the turn of the 20th century. He was the first African-American to get a Ph.D. from Harvard and was a founding member of the NAACP. But in light of civil rights leaders like Dr. King and Malcolm X, how relevant is he? I decided to dive into Du Bois' famous work, The Souls of Black Folk. In it, he wondered how blacks living as second-class citizens could ever really know themselves.
It's a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder.
That's Michelle Elam, Associate Professor of English at Stanford. I asked what Du Bois was trying to tell America in 1903 when he wrote The Souls of Black Folk.
African Americans, as he was representing them, were interested in integration, but not assimilation. That passage we read a little bit in Souls of Black Folk talks about that he doesn't want to bleach his Negro soul in a flood of white Americanism, but he also feels that white America has much to teach African Americans and Africa in general. And he's very interested in advancing the sense that the learning goes both ways. One of the things that's fascinating about The Souls of Black Folk is it's really got two audiences. It's certainly writing for his peers, but it also is explicitly geared towards whites, trying to reveal the world behind the veil, trying to give white people an appreciation of what it is like to experience blackness in the country.
Du Bois saw higher education as the way up, says Stanford philosophy professor Lanier Anderson.
Du Bois thought the social problems faced by whites and blacks in the American South are incredibly complex, and that without genuinely broad-minded people on both sides, the grave injustice of the social situation that those people found themselves in was destined to lead to disaster.
Anderson says Du Bois was philosophical about the color line.
When Du Bois says at the beginning of Souls of Black Folk that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, he means that not only as a sociologist, he also means to point out that the problem of the color line as it existed interior to the psychological and moral lives of African-American people themselves, they faced in much starker terms a fundamental human problem that we all face about the way that we should reconcile our own individual self-conception with a conception of ourselves that's driven by the society around us.
The NAACP said of him in 1934 in an official resolution, he created what never existed before, a Negro intelligentsia.
Stanford professor of English, Arnold Rampersad.
To enter into the intellectual world of black America and race is to enter into a world that is really dominated by Du Bois. There is something in Du Bois for almost every aspect of the American condition, where the American condition impinges on the question of race. And America is race. I mean, it's a racial conundrum. It was in 1900. It still is today.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that report. And thanks to Michelle Elam, Arnold Rampersad, and Lanier Anderson. So, Ken, what do we got today?
Well, we're joined today by Lucius Outlaw, professor of philosophy, director of the African-American Studies Program at Vanderbilt University, author of lots of things, but most recently, In Search of a Critical Social Theory in the Interest of Black Folk. Lucius, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Ken, thank you very much. And John, thank you both for the show, this focus on Du Bois, and for inviting me to be a part of it.
Well, you're very welcome, Lucius. We're really glad to have you. Let me start with this. Now, Du Bois was a great social activist and a great social theorist. He was also a philosopher, but let's put that aside for a moment and tell us what drove him to leave the academy and become this activist? And how did it have to do with his basic social theory, his approach to that?
I think part of it was an experience in Atlanta at one point where there had been a lynching of an African American, and where some white folks participating in the lynching had cut off parts of his body and put them on display in the picture window of a store on a main street in Atlanta. And that, I think, was so troubling to Du Bois, but another thing, at some point he came to the conclusion that rational persuasion using science was not going to really get it done, that it was going to take more engaging public discourse of a kind that he talked about as propaganda, that is, not just scientific studies, but persuasive articulation with a broad public was going to have to get at this problematic if we want to make a change.
But scientific studies, were his social activism not tied to a scientific study? I mean, I think of him as a great astute observer and theorist of race identity and culture and politics. Were the two sides of him divorced? I mean, did they cooperate?
I don't think they were divorced, Ken. I think it's how do you understand doing certain kinds of work, and how do you articulate it for what audiences? It's one thing to give a talk, as he does in 1897, to the American Academy of Political and Social Science, a learned body of people, of academics and specialists. It's another to edit Crisis magazine, a magazine that goes out and sustained largely by subscriptions of ordinary people, mostly African-American people, throughout the country, who are paying to read what is going on. Those are two different audiences. And there's a question about how do you reach these various audiences? And I think that it was reaching this wider audience, as the person said in the clip before, when he did, if you read The Souls of Black Folk, he's talking to several audiences there, not just one. And he was trying to reach a wider literate audience, not just people who would consume what we regard as, evidence-based scientific articulations in learned journals and those kinds of things.
I mentioned earlier when I was growing up, we heard a lot about George Washington Carver and Booker T. Washington. We didn't hear beans about Du Bois. But he took on their conceptions of the role of African-Americans in American life. How big a part did that debate play in his development as a public intellectual?
Well, it played a huge part. I mean, I think there's a point at which, particularly when he comes to take on Booker T. Washington, it's a watershed moment for him, and it's in The Souls of Black Folk as the essay of Mr. Booker T. Washington and others. And he knew that when he was taking that step of a public criticism of Washington, that he was taking on one of the major figures, black figures, in the country at the time, who was the power broker of influence between black folk and white folk in the country. And he knew that this was going to be a watershed moment for him. It was a watershed moment. One of the consequences was Booker T. Washington ultimately closed off all financial resources going to Atlanta University, which is one reason he said, I need to get out of here before Atlanta ends up starving. And so he goes to New York when he's invited to come up and do Crisis magazine, et cetera.
What was the big debate between Washington and Du Bois about? I mean, what was the issue? Help our listeners understand. What was at stake, and why was there such passion between them?
I think there were a couple of things. One was, one of the central notions of the late 19th century for white folk and white folk who were thinking about, how do you shape historical unfolding? One of the central notions was two notions in particular. One was character, and the other was manliness or manhood, generalized across the whole population of men and women. One of Du Bois's criticisms of Washington was that he articulated things in a way that there were white people who use it to their advantage to think that he was accommodating racial segregation and invidious discrimination. Now, Du Bois was clear that Washington wasn't sanctioning that, but he thought that Washington needed to be a bit more careful in his articulation so as not to mislead people into thinking that he was endorsing that. He said the cost of that accommodation was too high. It sapped the manhood of African-American people. Furthermore, there was a real disagreement about education, not whether that should be a Tuskegee or a Fisk or Talladega, one providing vocational education, one providing education for what we call the talented tenth. It was that Booker T. had become so influential and had become so partisan that he became the control point for resources flowing into the education of black folk throughout the nation. And Booker T. began to contain, really control and limit the amount of resource that would go to places like Fisk and Tuskegee.
So he was kind of a kingmaker, as it were. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is W.E.B. Du Bois. Our guest is Lucius Outlaw from Vanderbilt University.
In our next segment, we're going to dig deeper into some of Du Bois' main ideas about identity, race, and culture. Now, out there in our listening audience, we know you've got a lot of ideas about this. You're just sitting there thinking about it. Don't do that. Pick up that phone and give us a call when the time is right. Our number is 415-841-4134. That's 415.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Double consciousness, the souls of black folk, white folk too, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Long ways from home, a long ways from home.
Paul Robeson, who, like W.E.B. Du Bois, our subject for today, died in self-imposed exile from his native America. His Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we're discussing the philosophy of W.E.B. Du Bois. Have you ever experienced double consciousness? Have you ever lived behind a veil? Ever known what it's like to be experienced by another, another who has power over you, as a problem?
Join us. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
5-9917. Email comments at philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Lucius Outlaw from Vanderbilt University. Now, look, Ken and Lucius, American philosophy is gifted right now with a lot of very prominent, wonderful African-American philosophers. And I'm sitting here in a conversation with two of you. W.E. Du Bois must have had a big influence on your conception, on your ability to take this as an aspiration. Let's hear a little passion about that. How about it?
Indeed he did. Remember, John, I'm a graduate of Fisk University, so my encounter with Du Bois was pretty profound as a student at Fisk University. And when I went off to graduate school and began writing my dissertation, the lead-off epigraph for my dissertation is really From the Souls of Black Folk, and it is that segment that speaks about, you know, double consciousness. So he had quite an impact on me.
So tell us, okay, so Du Bois has had quite an impact on you. And I was reading one of your work papers recently, and you said something about returning over and over again to Du Bois' work on race. Tell me about Du Bois. How did he conceive of the very idea of race? And then we'll segue into talking about the particularity of black consciousness. But how did he conceive of the very idea of race?
Well, initially around 1897, one of the ways he thought about it, at least where he begins to articulate it in writing, is of what he calls a vast family shaped fundamentally by what he said sociology and history, not by biology. You know, that has some part to play, but very, very little. It's not, racial groups are not defined by biological characteristics, but by shared language, shared experiences, shared history, shared religion, etc. As I said, he thought of them as a vast family, and he wrestled with this notion throughout his very long life of 95 years.
So he was, like most thinkers about race today, not a biological essentialist. He didn't think the biology of it was very important. But he thought culture was very important, and mostly positive. He wasn't for just kind of assimilating.
People
still disagree about that, as I understand.
Well, let me ask you a question, though. Okay, what makes me, I'm an African-American, and a Ghanaian, who's of African descent, what makes us members of the same race by this way of thinking? The culture in which I have been reared and which deeply imbues my veins is some version of an American culture. It's not.
Sure.
I mean, what makes me and the Ghanaian a member of the same race by his lights?
Well, I think for him it's going to be part genealogical. That is going to play a part. It's not going to be the determining part. It's an initial conditioning. The rest is going to be, again, what he says, sociology, history, etc. Have you had very similar experiences? Now, there clearly is a genealogical story to be told there about people from the continent of Africa being brought to the United States.
Right, but that sounds biological.
Slave.
Historical.
Thank you, John. It's historical. It is also cultural because there are cultural continuities that will be sustained across multiple generations throughout the period of enslavement, even into the 20th and 21st centuries. So the history sociology part is worth looking at and appreciating deeply, not just the biological ones there. And the extent to which the Ghanaian and the African-American are of the same race, again, it depends on how you understand the concept and how tightly you want to have the connections be drawn in some way. They can be drawn fairly loosely, the way in which we say people who are white in the U.S. are of European descent. We don't generally have a problem saying that.
Well, let me press you just a little bit further then, just to see how the Du Boisian conception goes. Because, okay, I take the situation of people of African descent in America. They are faced with a problem and a challenge, and they have to forge an identity and a culture out of that situation that is different from any problem that an African is faced with, right? I mean, the Ghanaian has to deal with all sorts of things, but they're not the things with which I have to deal with. If, you know, and if my racial identity emerges out of that, in what sense, again, I'm wondering, is it deep to say that the Ghanaian and I are of the same race? I mean, there might be some similarities, but in what sense, is there some deep sense in which the Ghanaian...
Well, I mean, let's back up for a moment. If you say the Ghanaian, well, who colonized Ghana? Who settled in the U.S.? I think by the time we're done with answering that question, we're going to find that some of the very same people were settler colonies of both Ghana and the United States of America and thus had involvement with people of African descent. So to say that the experiences of the African-American and those of Ghana are not the same, I think that's much too quick a judgment to draw. There will be differences. There are going to be some similarities, and the similarities, I would argue, are not going to be trivial. The differences will not be trivial either, and that makes for some of the interesting complexities. To me, one of the interesting things about Du Bois is that he constantly attended to complexities and nuance and never sought simple conceptual solutions for challenging issues.
You know, I think some of his insights are probably truer today than even they were then, because the technology with which we can build this public conception of a person are so great now and so available. I think of Muhammad Ali's visit to Africa, where there was no doubt this deep sense of unity between him and the Africans who went to Zaire to see the fight. Mm-hmm. And that was all televised all around the world. I mean, these identity creation machines are 24/7, and to have the integrity to kind of define yourself independently of them is pretty difficult.
What do you think about that, Lucas?
I think that's right. And remember, I think it has always been a troublesome prospect for significant numbers of white folks who were in power and participated in white supremacy and the domination of folks of African descent. It was always a real concern on their part that there not be, transatlantic shared consciousness of folks of African descent. And they worked hard to promote a sense that there was nothing in common on those various people. They did not want the United States of Africa. They did not want a serious Pan-African movement to take root and to grow. It was too threatening. Now they can form Pan-European alliances. They can form NATO alliances. They can form alliances with Europeans in America and see themselves as sharing in one civilization that begins in Greece. Have no problem with that.
Yeah.
And we in philosophy don't tend to really tackle that, Ken. We tend to go right ahead promoting the notion that Plato and Aristotle are ancestors of Europeans and Americans.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing W.E.B. Du Bois with Lucius Outlaw. Our number... 415-841.
You're hearing an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
And Ulysses is on the line from Emeryville. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ulysses.
Yes, welcome. Congratulations on a fine show and a beautiful choice of subject matter at this critical time. I'd like to pose a question for your distinguished guest, Professor Lucius Outlaw. Hopefully, President E. Gordon Gee is still president of Vanderbilt. Masters of Laws together at Columbia before you scholars were born. The question about...
Some of them.
W.B. Du Bois, with respect to Booker T. Washington, let's fast forward to the modern era. Now, as a graduate of Bolt Hall Law School here in Berkeley and a former Hoover Institute scholar, I am constantly interested in the differences between the amount of low income and students of diversity that are admitted to Stanford as opposed to Berkeley. Now, in the face of 209, Berkeley is under constraints, but at Stanford, which is a private school, not subject to the legal constraints, there is a higher proportion, and I think outright numbers, of students of color, irrespective of income, at Stanford than it is in Berkeley. Now, at Vanderbilt, I understand, is a private institution, and I'd like Professor Outlaw to tell us what we could do as public interested in education to increase the number of students of diversity in the public institutions in the face of attitudes like 209. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Ulysses. 209, you know, 209 is a California proposition. Yeah, right.
Yeah, Proposition 209, sure. And thank you, Ulysses, for that question. And go and get your still Chancellor Vanderbilt, and I'll try and pass on your good thoughts regarding him. It is a difficult challenge for public institutions, but I think it's not an impossible one. The Supreme Court in the Michigan cases rule against the strategy being deployed by the undergraduate segment of University of Michigan, but support the one by that was being deployed by the law school. And basically what they said was you can't use firm numerical quotas, so to speak. You can't use those to figure out how you're going to get people of color into these institutions. Race can, however, continue to be a factor, among others, as you begin to measure how you're going to admit people into an institution. So public schools, you know, can do this. It just has to be a bit more nuanced, not very crude and fast, like we'll take 10% African Americans, we'll reserve those seats. But they can build diverse classes. And you know, for example, in Vanderbilt, we don't have scholarship programs that are reserved for only for African Americans. We have scholarship programs that have criteria. Race is some factor in there, but other things weigh equally as heavily, if not more, in terms of how we bring people in with those scholarships. And we're getting record numbers into the university.
Lucius, let me focus you back to Du Bois a little bit, segueing off the point you just made. One of the things some people think is that the key to a just society is transcending conceptions of race, a colorblind society in which race is just regarded as a source of invidious distinctions, right? And so it doesn't track anything deep or morally significant. I don't think Du Bois would have agreed with that. And from your writings, I don't think you agree with that either. Tell me about that.
You're right on both counts. I don't agree with it. And most people on the planet, I think, don't agree with it if you look at how they live. And Du Bois certainly didn't. I was looking today at one of his essays in 1960, 3 years before he dies, in which he's urging African Americans in particular that we must continue to have, you know, racially defined institutions, literature, art, et cetera, how you said, but they must be open to all, and they must be founded on the principle of universal brotherhood. To me, Du Bois was what I call a pluralist integrationist. He wanted a world with diverse peoples who contributed to the world, and that all people in the world would partake of what other peoples in the world had contributed. It was that rich diversity that would enrich us all if we would attend to it respectfully. So he doesn't want us to not know that people are from different cultural groupings, ethnic, racial, how we define them, but in fact to know that as one of the grounds by which we appreciate and respect them.
Marion in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marion.
Thank you. Yes, I wanted to make a comment because I'm also a Ghanaian-American, and I think that this speaks really to this entire question of double consciousness and what is the link and how do we understand race, because I grew up in a small town in Connecticut, and so in many ways one could say that, you know, quote, culturally I'm white, yet in my experiences in that town as well as now that I live in the Bay Area, but primarily in that town, I was always seen as black, and my being from Ghana was secondary, if not tertiary, in me. That was really not the most important aspect of my identity. And I wouldn't say that, you know, I claim that identity as much as it was forced upon me. And so I think that when we start talking about a colorblind society, that that's really quite unrealistic because people are positioned according to how they look. And that's the comment I wanted to offer.
Lucius, want to respond to that?
Sure, and I think that's right. And, you know, as John said early on, the double conflict was not only about how I understand myself, it's about how do others see me, and as the caller just said, how do they position those that they view in certain kinds of ways. Now, again, what I want to hold out as a prospect is that we can have identifications that are not invidious, that they can be white, they can be African American, they can be Native American, they can be Hispanic, Latino, Jewish American, whatever. They do not have to be invidious by virtue of being distinct. So that is what I would like to see.
We've got an email that speaks to this kind of question of extending the concepts of diversity that we're looking at. This is from Marcia. Try being a very intelligent, constitutionally aggressive female in the 50s in America. Try it in the 60s. It's pretty common today. Speak up for yourself when you're a bitch. No one is allowed to make jokes using the N-word anymore, but bitch jokes are still okay on TV. Go on. Try to tell me about double consciousness, .. You just read between the lines. She's a little ticked off.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, in fact, yeah, I take her point to be, look, this is not just about racial group. This has also been a problematic for women. And that, you know, we have had to work out in this society how to appreciate women more for who they are without, on the first, denying that they had certain capabilities beyond simply being managers of the household and producers and nurturers of children, but also to come back and say, even as women, they may have certain kinds of attributes that are beneficial to all of us and which we can benefit if we attend to them properly.
I agree.
We are not all the way there yet.
I agree with you entirely, Lucius, but I think it even goes further. I think it's part of the modern problematic, because I think one of the things that modernity has done is put all these people rushing into contact with one another, seeing what they want to see in each other. I mean, why did the Europeans see all these people that they encountered as other, because they wanted to exploit them, and they needed a rationalization or a reason or whatever. They needed something that would justify to themselves their exploitation. Of course, the people who were being exploited wanted to resist, but the Europeans had all this power. So it's this great whirl and twirl of modernity, this seeing and resisting other seeing and trying to make them see you as you see yourself, and them trying to appropriate your own vision of yourself. It's a great whirl of modernity. So I think it's deep within all of us.
Well, I think Marcia. Right. I just think Marcia has a good point, though. I mean, in the what are we, the tens of the 21st century, the 90s, and now, women really have almost a triple consciousness problem, because they're supposed to be super moms. At the same time, they're unfulfilled if they're not out there earning a living and having a professional identity, and then they just have to be themselves. These things are pretty difficult.
So you were about to say, Lucius.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I was going to say, one of the things, I mean, modernity to me was a deeply conflicted and dishonest project. On the one hand, you get these claims about, you know, of a political philosophy of liberal individualism, et cetera, and this is going to open the world up to freedom, et cetera. But that was fundamentally designed for white people, because modernity is really a project also of the expansions of peoples from Europe out to other parts of the world who, as you say, Ken, are bent upon acquisition.
Yeah.
And who are endowed by their own reason as well as by their gods to acquire at the expense of other peoples, including eliminating them through killing them if need be.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing W.E.B. Du Bois with Lucius Outlaw of Vanderbilt University.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
We've been talking about Du Bois' conception of race and his analysis of the interlocking racial consciousness of blacks and whites in America. When we continue, we're going to talk about the continuing significance of Du Bois' ideas.
Race and the 21st century, plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Mahalia Jackson and How I Got Over. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the philosophy of W.E.B. Du Bois, who said that the problem of the 20th century was the problem of the color line. Do we still face that problem in the 21st century, or have we transcended it?
Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917. Finally, comments at philosophytalk.com. www.wbdubois.org gets us email.
We've got an open line, so give us a call. You can get in. You can get in pretty quickly. Lucius, look, I want to. The last thing you were saying. Look, you know, in the old days, a long time ago, in 1000 A.D. or something, you asked somebody, "What is your race?" Some woman from Africa. She would be puzzled at the question. These concepts of race came into existence, I think, and they became prominent in our social life when the Europeans encountered the other and had to explain them to themselves and justify their exploitation. So that makes me think the way to a more just cosmopolitan world order might be just to explode these concepts, which are just they were thought up in the service of imperial exploitive projects anyway, so they just need to be exploded. Why not? And if you look at them as biological, they're completely empty.
Well, they're not completely empty, Ken. They may not do all the work that people would want them to do, but they're not completely empty. I mean, it really is a case that you've got diverse groups of people. Let's call them population groups and breeding population groups where there are biological things going on, and that's pretty clear. And if we watch what continues to unfold with, you know, with decoding the human genome, I think we're going to get even more confirmation of this. It will be a different conception of race than the old, you know, 19th, 18th, 17th century notions. Furthermore, I would say the concept of race may not have been plausible if you go back a couple of thousand years ago, but if you ask people, were they part of some lineage, some group of people that were defined in part through descent, the answer to that is going to be virtually for every group of human beings ever been on the planet. The answer is going to be yes.
Stephen in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephen.
Yeah, hi. I am wondering about whether or not there are any inherent characteristics about race, and I wanted to propose the following thought experiment. If we go back to the time when Europeans made contact, or more significant contact, with the African continent, and we just flipped roles where Africans had, you know, reliable international capacity to go on ships and weaponry that was advanced. If we just switched the roles, would there be anything different?
Good hypotheticals. Stephen, what do you think, Lucius?
Well, I mean, I don't know how you would answer that hypothetical. I mean, you know, one thing is you'd say, well, okay, what were African people's encounters with other people on the continent? Were there wars? Were there endeavors of conquest? And the answer to that is going to be yes. Did they have some of the same conception? I think if you say, well, let's just flip the script in some sense, you've got to look much more closer to folk and ask, were they driven to move around the world with a notion of conquest, armed by their gods or their gods, to take charge of the land and other peoples and dispose of them if they would once they come? I think the answer, I think, is going to be no. We don't seem to have much evidence of that. So I think there are some clear differences that we'd have to get at here.
Okay, let me pressure just a little bit more on this point about the conservation, to use a Du Boisian, of race in the 21st century. I mean, let's grant the project of forming identity is a complicated project. And any person's identity has multiple competing, interlocking, perhaps cooperating strands. How significant, as such, are the racial strands in the constitution of one's identity? I mean, is it more important that I'm a black man, that I'm an American, that I'm a philosopher, that I'm, you know, a Westerner, that I'm an English speaker? I mean, is it up to me? Is it up to society? How do those things, how are those things adjudicated?
Well, they're adjudicated in a number of different kinds of ways. Sometimes it's up to us, but as newborn human beings, none of it is up to us. It is all done socially in our behalf. So we don't get to choose a great deal of our identity for most of our lives. By the time we come to the point where we can make a choice and strike out on our own sense of who we are, we've already acquired identifications of a very complicated kind of sort, you know, bequeathed to us by home, school, church, synagogue, mosque, you know, voluntary organization of all kinds. We can then go rework those. The question of, you know, what is most significant in some sense is partially an individual question. It is also partly a social question. The more complex, the more complex societies we live in.
Yeah. So Du Bois said, though, the history of culture, I can't remember the exact quote, is the history of races. But if race is just one thing among others that constitute culture and identity, is that the right way to think about it? Isn't race just a strand that runs through history?
Well, but again, I think you'd have to go back and ask the following question. to what extent have those kinds of identifications been very crucial for human beings in terms of how they then mobilize their resources and engage in activities of shaping the world in which they live? It turns out it isn't just one strand among others. It has to do with the fundamental way in which people understand themselves through connection with other human beings, through lineages and their place in the world, such that, to quote Aristotle, man as a political animal seeks to leave behind those who will look like him. Now, if Aristotle is right, it is not simply one strand among other strands, Ken. It is a pretty fundamental one for human anthropology.
So that means that the problem of the 21st century remains the problem of the color line or not? That's what I was trying to set up.
Yeah, well, I think it will, but not necessarily in the same terms. My hometown in Starkville, Mississippi, is not constructed in the same way as it was when I was a kid growing up. They're still racial notions. They don't mean quite the same thing. Black and white folk don't operate toward each other in the same way. It's an evolving set of conceptions. Race is still in play, but the very meaning of it and the politics that flow from those notions of race have been transformed significantly.
Well, I think we can say with some confidence that the color line will not be the only problem of the 21st century. It looks like the religion line and the question of whether America is going to rule the world or not, or give up this silly ambition. We got plenty of problems on our plate, but my guess is the race one won't go away.
Lucius, on that note, we're going to have to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for joining you. It's been joining us. It's been great fun.
And thank you so much for having me, and thanks again for the show.
Our guest has been Lucius Outlaw, professor of philosophy and director of the African American Studies Program at Vanderbilt University, author of In Search of Critical Social Theory in the Interest of Black Folk.
We want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to and a couple of emails we didn't have a chance to work in. We really appreciate these calls and emails even when we don't get to them. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. So, John, what are you thinking today? I mean, is the problem of the 21st century? You just said it's not the problem of the 21st century.
Well, you know, I guess we're sitting here in the 21st century about where Du Bois was in the 20th century when he said race was going to be the problem of the 20th century. I just as soon not know what's going to look back on the 21st century and be the big problem. We've got so many potential ones. We might destroy the ecological balance of the earth. America might turn completely into a tyranny. Islamic fundamentalism and Christian fundamentalism and all kinds of fundamentalism may paradoxically emerge at the very time when science and philosophy and all the positive intellectual parts of human life are reaching their zenith. It's a big mystery to me.
Yeah, it's a big mystery. I have to say, I think I disagree with Lucius a little bit. I often wonder, so I think of myself as an African-American, but I ask myself, what does the African and African-American mean? If you ask a Ghanaian what his Africanness is, it'll be something very concrete in particular, or Nigerian, or South African. For an American of African descent, it can't mean anything like any of those particular identities. So I often wonder, what does that really, really mean?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm feeling pretty good about Philosophy Talk, Ken. I think that if our listeners or our non-listeners will go out and download listen on the internet to our conversations with Anthony Appiah and our conversation today with Lucius Outlaw and get the ones that are available on podcasts, they'll really have a good introduction to a lot of good thinking about the role of race in America.
Yeah, and they can also, you know what else they can do? They can go and read your blog that you put up today on our blog, the blog.philosophytalk.org. I'm going to put one up. I'm writing it called The Many Souls of Black Folk. On that blog, our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
Well, you can pick up podcasts of our program on the website as well.
You hear that sound? That signal's my favorite part of the show.
You mean the commercial? This is commercial-free radio, Ken.
No, I mean the conundrum.
Oh, it's conundrum time.
Yeah, and we have a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ann.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Where are you calling from, Ann?
From Portland, Oregon.
Oh, lovely Portland, Oregon. What a great place.
We're going to be up there to do a couple of live shows.
Oh, stop in for a cup of coffee.
What do you do up there in lovely Portland?
I'm a museum curator.
So why don't you tell us your conundrum?
Well, it's been going on for about a year now. I have a very good friend who died, and her adult children asked if I would make a quilt out of her clothing.
Are you a quilt maker, an accomplished quilt maker?
I am. I actually never take commissions or agree to make quilts for people because it is such a labor-intensive thing.
So this sounds like a real gift from you. I mean, something you did out of really the kindness and goodness and concern for your friend.
For my friend who died, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know her kids as well, but I loved her. And I finished them by Thanksgiving, which was working very hard and fast, and I called them at Thanksgiving, each the son and the daughter, and got no response, and I called again and reached the son, who said that they were on their way out of town and that they would call me when they got back after the holiday. I didn't hear anything from them, and I called again at New Year's and called both of them and left them email messages. A year went by and heard nothing, and I had two quilts in my sewing room, and I had pretty much just decided that I would never contact them again because I had already done my part to let them know that the quilts were done and ready, and I felt pretty underappreciated. Last October, I ran into the daughter at a store, and she talked breezily about the year and how things had been going for them. I've been getting regular emails from them because they're in a folk music group, and she, you know, said, "Why haven't you come to hear us?" And, "Oh, and by the way, I wanted to talk to you about those quilts that you said you'd make." And at that point, I said, "Well, you know, I did make them, and I did contact you, and you said you'd call me back. And at this point, I think I'm going to do something else with the quilt." She was shocked and hurt and said, "Well, it's been a very hard year for us." And I acknowledged that, you know, I, thank God, have not lost my mother. I know that it's got to be a hard year, not so hard that they couldn't get their folk music group up and running, and mm-hmm. not so hard that they couldn't take trips, but so hard that they couldn't email me and say, "We can't come get the quilt right now." I told her that she couldn't have them, and then she left. And now that I've done that, my conundrum is I feel like I might have accomplished what I set out to do, which was to not feel like a doormat. But I did intend the quilts to go to them, and however badly they acted, I feel like those clothes are always going to be their mother's clothing.
You don't want to be a doormat, and you think that by standing up for yourself and expressing your displeasure with them, you kind of made the case that you weren't a doormat, but now you want to give it. Them the quilt, you're worried that that would make you a doormat all over again. Is that right?
Well, I agreed to make them. They asked me to do something, and I said that I would. And is it really my place to punish them for behaving badly?
You know, when you said, she says she's had a rough year, but how rough can it be? They kept the folk music thing going. Well, you don't really know that either. I mean, basically, you probably don't know much about what happened to her. She's got lots of other relatives. She could have had some illness or something. One thing I think you ought to consider is inviting her to lunch and kind of clearing the air between you. Say, "You know, I think you underestimated how much trouble it was to make this quilt, and I was a little harsh in my judgment of your not calling me. So why don't we talk this out?"
John, you sound like such a wise, caring person. You surprise me.
I sound like a wuss.
Your idea makes it sound like that gives her the opportunity to apologize.
Yes.
Well, what's wrong with that? That sounds good.
The problem is, if she does apologize, you probably have created a situation you pretty much have to give her the quilt anyway.
Yes, I think if I do that, that's only if I've already decided that she gets the quilt.
It's clear to me you don't want to be a doormat. You put it that way yourself. What other kind of person do you want to be? Do you want to see yourself as a forgiving person? I mean, how much does it matter to you to see yourself as a forgiving person? Because if you want to see yourself as that, then make yourself that. I mean, if you don't want to see yourself as a doormat, then don't be a doormat. So tell me, what do you want to see yourself as?
Well, it'd be really horrible to not say I want to see myself as a forgiving person, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. Does that weigh more than not wanting to see yourself as a doormat?
Well, I think complicating everything is the fact that I have, in the last year, decided that I'd really like one of these quilts.
Well, I think, here's one possibility. Wrap up one of the quilts very nice. Send it to the daughter with a note saying, "I really feel you ought to have this. Right now I'm feeling a little unappreciated, but maybe someday you'll make a quilt and understand how much love went into this."
Well, that sounds like a perfect solution.
But, Anne, I think you made John's day. You said a perfect solution. I don't think anybody's ever said that to him about any idea of his. Yeah. But I hope we've helped you think about your conundrum a bit.
You certainly did. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Anne, and say hi to Portland for me.
We will. Looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah, and come listen to us when we get up there.
I will.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Rujin Shen, Neil Van Leeuwen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University. the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.